Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 134 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. And now, on to what is, it's kind of, I feel sad about it. I feel okay about it. I feel strange that we're in this place, but now on to what is the last section of the read-along for Dragonfly and Amber. We are beginning and ending our Dragonfly and Amber read-along, part 7. Hindsight, chapter 47, which is entitled Loose Ends.
Lisa T. writes, chapter 47 opens with Claire back in 1968. Quote, "He was right, of course. Bloody man, he was almost always right." Claire sounded half cross as she spoke. A rueful smile crossed her face. Then she looked at Brianna. Unquote. I love that she still, even after 20 years, gets twisted with Jamie and refers to him as a bloody man. So we are back in the 20th century. Claire finishing her tale to Brianna and Roger. Brianna is sitting on the rug, blank-faced.
Claire's, I mean, what else would she be doing?
Claire says the pregnancy was again dangerous and Bree's birth was hazardous. Had she stayed in the 18th century, she says she almost certainly would have died along with the baby. Roger, Diana writes, felt like an intruder being a witness to this intimate scene. Claire says, quote, "The truth then, all of it. I couldn't bear to leave him, even for you. I hated you for a bit, before you were born, because it was for you that he'd made me go. I didn't mind dying, not with him, but to have to go on, to live without him. He was right. I had the worst of the bargain, but I kept it because I loved him. And we lived, you and I, because he loved you." Brianna asks her mom, "How long did you hate me?" She answers, "Until you were born." Quote, "When I held you and nursed you and saw you look up at me with your father's eyes. And then I began to know you as something separate from myself or from Jamie. And I loved you for yourself and not only for the man who fathered you." Unquote. So Brie is in denial still, saying that Frank Randall was her father. Brianna has a very difficult time with this, and understandably so. She says that her mom must still hate her, and that there is no way Daddy, Frank, could have loved her, Brianna, if she weren't his. And then she lashes out, "He didn't love you, I know that." Roger observes this scene and sees Brianna as a Highland warrior come to life. Claire also observes this passion in Brianna and recognizes it as Jamie's. Lisa T. writes, "Then in a move reminiscent of Jamie, Brianna goes epic Fraser on her mother." Brianna grabs the newspaper clippings and throws them into the fire. She calls her mother a bitch and tells her that she hates her. Then she throws the poker through the front window.
Yeah, see, that I think that's where you...
Where you lose you?
Yeah, because I was like, I could see all of that being like irrational.
With the poker?
Right, but then all of a sudden it was just like, it became a tantrum too far.
I agree with the tantrum. I don't know about too far because my world has never been shattered like hers just was. And it's not been like, I'm going to tell you, your dad's not your dad. This has been an entire, well, at least from what we know, an entire day long of listening to someone basically destroy your life.
I have a hard time believing it was a day. I think that they're starving and they've been in there for probably a few weeks. I mean, it took me more than a day to read this book.
Diana writes about Brianna, quote, "But she turned, arm drawn back like a javelin thrower, and hurled the poker through the full-length window, where the panes of night-dark glass reflected the image of a burning woman for one last instant before the crash and shiver into empty black." Unquote. I love the line, or the part of that line, quote, "the image of a burning woman." Unquote. It's a little reminiscent or foreshadowing of Claire's close call and Galus's time travel that's coming up. Brianna flees. Fiona is banging pots and pans in the kitchen, getting ready for dinner. Roger and Claire are both at a loss for what to do. Claire asks him if he believes her. Quote, I'll be damned if I know, he replies. Roger then crosses to her and picks up her hand, looking for the scar of the carved J. He finds the faint line at the base of her thumb. She mentions several things, the scar, the pearls, the portrait of Ellen McKenzie, the one with the pearls, that could support her, quote, delusion, should someone claim that. She says that though these help support, they cannot prove her claim. She reiterates that finding out if Jamie had saved his men was important to her. She had to find out if it had all been worth it or if he'd sacrificed himself for nothing. And of course, she'd had to tell Bree and couldn't do so while Frank was still alive. Roger asks about her silver ring, the one Jamie had given to her. So she'd told him the story of Outlander as well? So obviously she told him how they met, not just the goings on in Paris. She would have had to.
Well, if she did...
How she went back. She
then it was definitely not something she did in a day. We were talking about 2 months at least.
Oh, summer.
I mean, it took us a year to read it, so it must have taken them at least.
We're
a
little
months.
Bit slower than Claire. She has firsthand knowledge. She'd be a lot faster.
I have a hard time, though, thinking that anyone sat still and quiet for that story.
It was a long story.
I mean, even
people
if
have to go potty.
I know, but let's wait. Even if she started the story at like breakfast time and it ended
at dinner time.
That's a long time for
so
no interjections.
She had to do bullets then. There's no way you can do everything that Diana wrote.
She could not have told all of that. And I don't think she would have. I don't think those are all details that you give your children.
You don't need to tell your daughter, and the way he entered me was so smooth. I mean,
smooth.
I didn't know.
And right before the
angle
I came back,
was perfect.
And right before I came back through the stones, he gave it to me one more time.
Exactly.
I mean... He gave it to me so I would never forget it. Okay. And I ran towards the stones with him leaking from me.
I was like,
that's not, you don't tell your daughter that
story. But don't worry, that wasn't you. You were already in there.
You were already safely stowed away.
And it didn't hurt you.
Good Lord.
So regarding her ring, if it had a maker's mark, that might at least prove it was from the period. It still can't prove that she went back, but it could prove it was from the period. She takes it off for the first time and notices that there are actually words in it. And she crumples after seeing them. She has finally lost some of her control. Roger meant to read the words out for them both, but it was Claire's voice that rang out. Dami basia mile. It was Catullus, a love poem. Hugh Monroe had given her the poem as a wedding present, along with that chunk of amber with the dragonfly in it. But there was no maker's mark. But for Roger, it's proof enough. Lisa T. writes, Claire and Roger are left alone. In a scene that is reminiscent of the scene in Outlander where Claire tells Jamie that she is from the future, Claire asks Roger if he believes her. Now this touches Claire. It means the world to her to be believed. As Claire loses all control, she says, quote, I never thought, it never occurred to me, I didn't know how much it would mean to have someone believe me, unquote. And then the irony. Claire says to live 20 years with the Jacobite scholar, but to be so afraid as to what she'd learn that she'd never been able to bear to open one of his books. Roger asks her, do you want me to tell you? And she nods. So Roger then goes through the men one by one and describes their end.
Did you say so Roger or Sir Roger? Because it sounded like Sir Roger.
As Roger.
It sounded like you said Sir Roger.
As he tells her of the demise of each of these men, Claire has to relive her past again. These men whom she'd known. The body of the young son of Balmerino was never found, actually. That was kind of probably one of the saddest ones. And the old fox indeed had been beheaded. He was tried for treason and condemned. He continues through the list. And then they take a break and go outside for fresh air. Now, it had stopped raining. Now, is that a Hemingway signal or what?
So no one's going to die tonight?
No, it's just like
usually
the sadness stops.
But usually you die in the rain.
Well,
that's what Hemingway's
or at least you, or so, yeah. But it's also sadness.
So the sky stopped
raining.
Stopped crying.
She and Roger go out for a walk, and Claire is thankful to be out of the house, and she can breathe much more easily. She's glad it's done, most of it. She hadn't realized how much she'd needed or wanted someone to remember Jamie with. Now, as they walked, she began to ask Roger small questions. Claire remarks that though they were drunkards, too proud of their honor to back down, all that was left of Charles and his men was the fact that they believed. They believed in what they sought. Roger says that she must be upset with historians who write the history so inaccurately, but Claire says no, they saw history as they were meant to see it. She says the problem is with the artists, the writers and singers, who take the past and recreate it to their liking.
Like Diana?
Yeah. As they are walking, they see the words Free Scotland tagged on a railroad bridge. Claire has a very interesting perspective, and it goes somewhat into what Summer and I have discussed about this book. Was there one thing that had to happen that Charles was meant to do or to be? Or was his role to be exactly what he was for what happened to have happened, so that there would be a figurehead, so that Scotland could retain its own identity even enduring 200 years of union with England? So Summer and I did not mention the figurehead, and we did not mention the union with England, but Summer and I, and other people too, we're not the only ones, have said this whole thing, once you talk about the Gabaldonian theory of time travel and all of this, it's like, it's what Claire said. You start second guessing everything you did. What was the one point? We talked about this in the discussion of at least chapter 46 and probably like a dozen others, right? At which point is it too late to turn back? Definitely one of those points was at Lallybroch when they got the letter of, or the broadsheet, the whatever you call it, of Jamie's forged signature. That's one of the points you can say, right? There's no turning back for Jamie, at least. Was it the point when Charles sailed to Scotland? That was definitely another turning point or point of no return. You can drive yourself mental trying to say, oh, what could we have done? What could we have done? Well, I mean, Claire went back in time, but in general, you can't go back in time to worry about this. And so I'm glad that Diana brings this up and touches on modern, even modern Scotland. At this moment, a train roars over the bridge above them. Claire says, quote, you never know. You have to act anyway, don't you? Unquote. She talks about how she learned as a doctor that she had to focus on the person in front of her, not worry about the ones she couldn't help, or she'd end up losing the one in front of her, too. This is her focus, her gift. And then they return to the manse. And I think the reason that she mentioned that was because the whole thing about second guessing yourself or not being able to change all of history, like that's actually very applicable to what Jamie and Claire talked about, or what Jamie says, like, look, we have not stopped Culloden, but I may be able to save my men, right? I may be able to do this one thing. Oh, okay. We may not have stopped it, but I'm going to see you and my baby safe. What she's talking about is what Jamie practiced. He did what he could. You can make plans, you can have the best of intentions, but when it comes down to it, don't lose the forest for the trees, right? Don't lose the trees for the forest. Don't think that if you're trying to save the whole forest, if you can't, save at least the few trees that you can in the manner of people. Roger is wondering why Claire chose to include him in all of this, in the telling of her tale to Brianna. Was she afraid of Brianna's reaction and she didn't want to do it alone? Or had she gambled that he would believe her and then she could enlist his help as an ally to her to help explain or prove the story to Brianna? They return to the manse and they push a bookshelf against the broken window, and Roger pours them each a whiskey. Claire says there are two reasons she wanted Roger to hear the story. First, there was the right to know who he was. She goes to the papers on the reverend's desk and finds the one she's looking for. Now, that stack must have been around since the 40s because she saw it in the 40s.
Yeah.
That family tree.
Well, and he said it made it sound like he never touched anything.
Yeah, exactly.
So if it was put there, it was probably remaining there.
So it was Roger's family tree. And she tells Roger of the correction on the family tree where his ancestor actually came from. She says past a certain point, I think it was the 17 something something, from there to the future, it was absolutely correct. But she said there was a mistake that was for the people who, for whatever records,
She basically said you could tear the entire top half off of this, off of this family tree, and everything underneath a certain point was absolutely accurate. But everything before that was not.
Yes. There's one mistake, but that one mistake makes everything before it change. And that is that the person, this one baby who was in this line had actually died. And the baby that the same family had adopted, they didn't, you know, re-enter it into the church log, right, as a baptism or whatever. So there would not have been a replacement. So that, she says, it makes sense it wasn't reflected in the records. But because the baby that had been basically homed with, adopted by the family that had the baby had died in, this is going to sound really wordy, and if you read, you'll know what I'm talking about. Because the baby was not the baby listed, that made everything before it incorrect. And she was about to fill him in on that. We find out that where the ancestor actually came from. To quote Gregory Maguire, his ancestor was the son of a witch.
I don't know what that's from.
Gregory Maguire wrote the book Son of a Witch, which is the book that Wicked is based off of.
Okay.
Actually, no, that was Wicked. The sequel to that was Son of a Witch. Sorry. So I was like, yeah.
I'm like, what?
Don't know what you're talking about. Well, we love Wicked, but apparently I didn't love it enough to remember that the book is actually called Wicked.
Yeah, there's that.
So this witch that his ancestor was the son of was Gilles Duncan. Something she had recognized in him was his eyes, her eyes. The second reason was that Gilles Duncan had a vaccination scar. Claire could forget everything for Frank and Jamie, but Gilles had saved her life at Cranesmere. She left her a message as well to give to Dougal, to give to Claire. And that was the year that she'd gone back, 1968, that year that they're in right now. She says that she thinks Gilles hadn't actually gone back yet. Claire had spoken with Fiona and gotten some information about Gilles. A tall, fair-haired woman with striking green eyes had also asked her for information. Her name was actually Jillian Edgars. Claire asks Roger if she should look for her. He says, of course. And then she asks, if we do find her, what happens to you? There are no answers, Claire says, only choices. And now it was his. He decides, let's find her. Meanwhile, Claire's fallen asleep.
I have a question. Did we see anywhere in this book or in the last book? I doubt it in the last book. Anywhere in this book where Colum actually told her where the baby was put? Because she said that Colum told her. Did I miss that? I don't remember that being something that was...
I think that was in Outlander.
Couldn't have been. Because after Cranesmere, she didn't see Colum.
The only person who could have told her would have been Dougal.
Yeah, but this book here says
Colum did it?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think... Did they even talk about Gilles when they talked?
I don't think
in
so.
In DIA?
I don't think so. Yeah, she says here, he would have been baptized at birth. After all, it wasn't necessary to do it again. Colum told me where they placed him. So I don't remember that conversation happening, but that's fine. Anyway, that was chapter 47. We're moving right along to chapter 48, entitled Witch Hunt. Witch Hunt.
In which they go a-hunting for Jillian Edgars. They're at the front door of a flat, ringing the buzzer. There was a trough of yellow jonquils by the doorstep, half dead, which signaled perhaps... Well, not perhaps, which signaled a lack of care. And as Summer knows, I like to look up trees and flowers and stuff. And I thought, I wonder if this is just something that is common there at this time of year, or if there was a meaning to it. So I had to look it up. Now, yellow jonquils from the site gardenguides.com. The flower is a fragrant little flower that blooms in March or April and resembles a daffodil. Its formal name is Narcissus jonquil. So it's a species of the larger Narcissus family, which is kind of interesting, right? If you know of the myth of Narcissus, and this is Jillian Edgar's home. Interesting. It is a small blossom and it blooms in groups of 2 to 6 on slender stems that are approximately 16 inches tall. The fragrance is stronger than any other Narcissus species. Now, one thing that I found most interesting was in the description of its significance. Quote, the jonquil flower is particularly important to those born in the third month of the year because jonquil is the marsh birth flower. As the birth flower, it represents domestic happiness and friendship. So we have these yellow jonquils, which represent domestic happiness and friendship, that are half dead in front of her home. Nice. Really nice. Good choice, Diana. So was anyone home at the house? Just as they turn to go, I think they hit the buzzer a few times, the door opens and a man answers. They say they are looking for Miss Jillian Edgars, and the man corrects them. She's actually Mrs., but she's not home. And the husband tells them to bugger off. They head off at that point to the Institute of Highland Folklore and Antiquities, a place where Fiona said Jillian took courses. The receptionist there, Mrs. Andrews, takes their inquiry, and Roger thinks he hears at that point a note of doubt creep into her voice. Jillian, it turns out, is a regular member and paid up for classes, and she's around quite a bit. The receptionist seemed not to be thrilled just how much Jillian was around. They find out that only the receptionist and Dr. McEwen are there on Mondays, and they're there on a Monday. So, did that ring any bells for you? A Dr. McEwen? No. The Dr. McEwen is the Dr. McEwen. Oh, I can't say that, can I? Let's just say Dr. McEwen pops up. I'm not saying it's the same guy, but a Dr. McEwen pops up in a much later book.
Noted.
Dr. McEwen is the director. The receptionist suggests that they see Dr. McEwen to ask about Jillian. Claire makes up some reason to view a photo of Jillian. She says, we wouldn't want to waste the director's time if it ends up being the wrong person. The receptionist pulls out a photo of a group of people at a dig, and she can tell it's her, but it's not really up close. And then another photo is one of her as well, this one in profile. Roger is appreciating how good his ancestor looks, and Claire nods that yes, it is indeed her. To get in to see the director, Claire makes up some cockamamie story that Jillian had applied for a study grant at Oxford, and she listed the Institute as a reference.
Her lying has really improved.
It's gotten
over the last, like, so much better. 20-something years.
Now, after Mrs. Andrews leaves to go see the director, Roger whispers in her ear, there is no such thing as the Department of Antiquities at Oxford, and you know it.
Well, they don't know it.
That's true. So he hopes that she can get them through this, tell the right lies that need to be told to get the info that they want. She says it'll be pie. She read souls for the King of France. He says, après vous, madame. And then he adds, après vous, le déluge. Her shoulders stiffen in response to this. So I, of course, had to look it up. Okay, according to the Wikipedia article called Après nous, le déluge. After us, the deluge. It's a French expression attributed to Marquise de Pompadour, the lover of King Louis XV of France. An alternative form is après moi le déluge, after me the déluge. The expression has two possible meanings. After me, the deluge will come, asserting that if the revolution ended his reign, the nation would be plunged into chaos. Or after me, let the deluge come, implying I don't care what happens after I'm gone. So they get in to see the director.
But I wonder if it was really just the French, the Frenchness of it. That.
Well, I don't think so, because he says, après vous, madame, and she goes. But then he says, après vous, le déluge. So he adds it. She did not stiffen when he used French. She only stiffened when she said that. She's like, oh, Lord. So they get in to see the director, and he asks them if they met Jillian, and they say no. That's why they're there, to talk to him. Claire asks if there's anything they should know about her. Personality-wise. The director says he can account for her scholarship. As to her personality, he says she's intense. Maybe a little bit obsessive? Now, Claire asks about the standing stones, and the director asks if that information showed up in her application. During this conversation, Roger is sweating like a whore in church. I mean, I guess not totally, not the same reason, but he was sweating. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. This woman, his possible ancestor, who traveled back in time this very year, studied here, was obsessed with the stones that Claire had traveled through.
You know, what strikes me about these conversations that they keep having, and they say they have this conversation both with the director at this institute and also later with Jillian's husband, is that they mention these standing stones, and I would think to, like, any normal person, like, that was obsessed with things like that, they wouldn't be talking to other people about it. Like, the fact that they were able to mention something as obscure as, oh, did she ever talk about these random circle of standing stones? And these people that they're asking are like, oh, yeah, oh, you heard about that, did you? She's clearly unhinged and has been, at least from before she went back. If she was already, like, I mean, clearly there was something else going on, because she did figure out how to do it and was able to do it, the traveling through the stones. But I don't know that I would let people in on my obsession before I made it happen.
So you would, you know, do like a private study and not go to that place like an institute where you're having all these people knowing about your business.
Exactly. I don't know if I was planning on offing my husband to use him as an offering to make sure that the stones
as
let
an
me
offering.
To make sure that the stones let me pass through, I definitely would not be letting him know about it. Because what if he did research into it and found out, oh, somebody has to die to do this? You know what? She doesn't like me all that much. I might be the person she's planning on killing and frying.
The director takes them to a locked carousel where, ostensibly, student notebooks were kept. A notebook with gray covers and the word miscellaneous written in handwriting on it sends a shiver through Roger.
What else would it be handwritten in?
I don't know, blood.
Handwritten in handwriting.
Yeah. As the director goes...
Okay, I don't know what a carousel is in the UK, but to me a carousel is a...
thing that you ride.
Yeah, with ponies and stuff on it.
As the director goes on about stuff, the stuff in the notebook or the stuff that Claire's asking him about, Roger can't get the feeling out of his mind. She wrote this. She's real. Flesh and blood and lips and long eyelashes.
How does he know about her eyelashes?
He saw them in the picture.
Okay.
I think the one with the profile. The director helps Roger out by taking him to the drinking fountain. Roger is, like I said, he's hot. He's sweaty.
Oh, yeah.
He's feeling a little bit probably overwhelmed.
That Roger, he's so hot right now.
They take him to the drinking fountain. As he gets further away from Jillian's writings, he feels better. Now, is this psychosomatic or is there something? We have a little bit of an answer later on, but is there something to the writings that holds some power? He seems to be reacting like Claire did as she approached the stones. Not as strong, of course, but a nasty, icky feeling. He couldn't continue. He would let Claire finish with the director. He goes back out into the area near the receptionist. And the receptionist remarked on the similarity between Jillian's eyes and Roger's eyes. Roger takes off.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
So back in the car on his way home from the Institute, after Claire joins him, of course, Roger asks, what's next? Claire says, why don't you ask Brianna out for supper somewhere?
He's like, that's not quite what I thought we were doing.
Could you say Claire is already laying the... Well, I guess you couldn't. See, I'm getting way too ahead of myself here. What I wrote was, could you say Claire is already laying the groundwork for something, something?
Well, I think...
No, because she doesn't have the answer of what end the book yet.
No, but I think that for several reasons, like she talked about almost like using Roger to like lessen the blow of it, to give... He actually played a very good part in both of their storylines in this book because he was there to be the sounding board for Claire and to be the first person on this side of the centuries to believe her. And he was also there to be the sounding board for Brianna to help coax her or guide her into the place of knowing where she believed it and didn't just call her mom a bitch.
And... since he did believe Claire, when Brianna came around, which I know she hoped and prayed for it, but I think she knew it would happen eventually, or hoped it would happen eventually.
Well, clearly the only thing that made that happen was watching
the stones. Yeah.
Seeing the stones.
So, but because he knew all of this, he had been in the room with her as she told the story. Once Brianna came around, he would thus be a safe person to speak with.
Yeah, someone she could talk to about it.
He's not going to think you're bonkers. He can support you. He can do research for you if you want to know more stuff. He's actually a good ball of stuff. Researcher, knowledge. He knows your business.
He's just a really good ball of stuff. Bunny.
A dust bunny.
Just a ball of stuff.
She suggests...
I don't even know what a dust bunny is made up of.
Bunnies.
No, it's really not. And they're like... skin
tumbleweeds or something,
skin and hair and
gosh, yuck. She suggests that he go speak with Greg Edgars again after dinner. She says he'd talk to him that night because he would go with a bottle of whiskey. So like Claire's got the whole night already planned. I was like, look, no, I'll suggest it, but you're gonna do it.
I mean, this is cake after the subterfuge of trying to have
no, it's not cake, it's pie.
Okay, it's pie.
After getting into the Institute?
No, I mean, after the court intrigue and all the crap she did in Paris, this is nothing.
Totally.
You couldn't even finish that yawn before you started talking?
Totally. Then she suggests he ask Brianna if she'll go with him to speak with Edgars. I did think that was a little awkward, but I understand why after the fact. So he does not want Brianna like anywhere near that guy. He's just a nut job, he thinks. So Claire
he's
suggests...
just drunk.
Yeah. Claire suggests he not tell her what he's up to. And but Claire says that she won't be joining them. She has something else to do. Claire thinks that Roger and Greg Edgars will, together, be able to convince Brianna that Jillian is gayless. He says he'll try. She says she'll be burgling the Institute.
Just nonchalantly.
Exactly. She wants that notebook.
Yeah, I'm just going to be an A. It's cool.
Lisa T. writes, the image of Claire burgling the Institute is so humorous, but also reminds us of all the scheming, as Summer said just now, that she was part of in France. One thing that is interesting to me is in these scenes is that Claire is always a bad liar. Everything shows on her glass face, and yet she's able to charm everyone into getting what she wants.
Like I said, she's apparently a lot better at lying than she used to be.
Roger and Brianna walk along the river together, chatting. She reveals that she knew so much about his work because Frank, her father, had taught her. They end up going to a pub for supper. The conversation becomes light and teasing. She asks him, with a whiskey bottle, if he's planning a rave-up. And then, showing off her new linguistic knowledge, says there's an American dance called the Shag, but he shouldn't do it with her, though.
No, she said, I shouldn't ask you to do that with me. And he's like, not unless you mean it.
He jokes, not unless you mean it. And she blushes. Diana writes, quote, he was conscious of a certain stirring at the suggestion that made him keep his coat hung over one arm instead of putting it on, unquote. I wrote, LOL, Roger's happy. Lisa T. writes, all I can think here is that poor Roger needs a kilt. They are very effective in hiding a random cock stand, at least according to Jamie.
I wonder, would it be though, or would it be more like pitching a tent?
It at least has folds and pleats. And if it's like voluminous, it'll hide it. Well, I say that with a lot of respect.
I'm like,
I cannot speak for a cock stand or someone who owns one.
I'm just saying, I'm imagining like a sheet. If you had a naked man in a bed in the morning with just a sheet lying over them, like
there's no
draped
hiding.
Sheet. There, it's like.
But that's not a kilt. Kilt's not flat and thin.
Well, it's not. But if it's not tight to your body and it has room to allow things to maneuver and grow and move in whatever way they would, I would be afraid that it, at a certain level, I mean, unless it's like really pleated, like with folds and hangings and things over the front, that it would just make more room for it to make itself known. I don't know.
All we know is
I don't know my kilt wearing friends out there. You
all
tell
I
me.
Know is he didn't have a kilt and he needed a cover.
Well,
she agrees. Brianna agrees to go with him to drop off the bottle. They go to Edgar's house and get in, telling him that he's a cousin of Jillian's. And Roger says that Brianna is his girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah.
The flat is atrocious. It smells of cigarettes. It's filled with furniture and remnants of takeaway meals. Yuck. Roger sees a photograph of Jillian, a very large one. Jillian isn't at home just now, Edgar says, but he offers them some whiskey and they ask where she is. He says, either with the gnats or the roses. And that is the Scottish Nationalists. Mr. Edgars says that that's where he'd met her. And at first it was great, but then she went potty. She started hanging with the Society of the White Rose. And she went on and on, he says, about the Bonnie Prince and wouldn't have been great if they'd won the 45. Then Roger asks if she'd been interested in the Standing Stones. Brianna is livid at this point. They learned that Jillian hadn't been seen in 2 weeks. As they leave, Mr. Edgars says, quote, if you see Jilly, tell her to come home, eh? Unquote. That just kind of made me sad.
Because she's planning to off him?
He doesn't really talk 100% nice about her, but he does say, you know, the place is a lot nicer when she's here. I mean, a little bit nicer,
well,
not
as
bad.
She cleans up after him.
Exactly. But he says, like, I met her, it was nice, and then it all went potty, and she's silly, she shouldn't be, he says stuff later, too. She shouldn't be taking those classes, wasting my money, that kind of thing. Yet, as they leave, because he thinks they have some sort of connection with her, right? As they leave, the last thing he says is, tell her to come home.
Yeah, but what if he wants her to come home so she'll clean? What if he wants her to come home so that, you know, she'll do something else for him? I don't know. He's not a sympathetic character. I refuse to find him.
It's sympathetic. I'm saying it's sad. What he's saying is sad. For whatever reason.
That's the most important part. What is the reason?
Brianna is demanding answers to questions once they're outside. Roger says that the woman in the picture was Gaylis Duncan. Brianna's like, I've had enough. I have people telling me 3 ways to Sunday that all this stuff about time travel and all this bullshizzle. And she's like, not you too. He says she can decide to keep out of it. But there's her mother also to consider. And him. He hadn't meant to tell her, but there we are. He realized that there was one way to prove Claire's story. To find Jillian Edgars and watch her go through the stones. Brianna asks, you believe her?
Specifically to watch her go through the stones? Did he say that?
Yeah.
But can we talk about how real lucky they were that she hadn't gone through yet? Like, what were the odds that they were going to make
the
it back to Scotland in time?
A Diana Gabaldon novel.
I know. Because there was a whole year. and it was already April, she could have gone already.
That's true. But if it was like October, I would have said you're like SOL just before May. So yeah, there was it was still more than half a year that there was a decent chance. Brianna asks, you believe her then? He says, yes, you had to see your mother's face when she saw the words written inside her ring. That was real. Real enough to break my heart. Brianna asks him to tell her. She is beginning to crack. Not like mentally, but like...
I think she is cracking a little bit mentally.
I think she cracked mentally when she called her mother a bitch and threw a poker through a window.
That's when she became a berserker.
Yeah, exactly. She says she can't think of it yet. The whole thing about her supposed 18th century father, blah, blah, blah. But she does say that she'll think of him.
But could you imagine, though?
No.
Could you imagine, like, having your mother...
tell you this?
Sit you down and be
can
like...
Can you imagine if our mother told her? Okay, first of all, it wouldn't happen to us unless we were twins. Because that's only one pregnancy. And she wasn't, like, skipping back twice to have babies in the other centuries.
No, it's not that. My whole point is, it's like, imagine a parent sitting you down to tell you you're adopted.
Like, oh, I see. You're not making it time travel.
No, I mean, I'm just saying that's hard enough. And that's hard enough to swallow when you have that whole sense of new identity. Like, I'm not who I thought I was, blah, 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 blah. But not only is your dad not who you thought he was, your real dad is from the past. So it's like there's so many levels. Like if she just started off slowly with your dad is not your dad. And then maybe waited a while and be like, oh, FYI, your dad is this other guy, blah, 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 blah. And then maybe a little later be like, oh, yeah, and I met him in 1700. So, I mean, I think...
43.
Exactly. My point is she could have staged it. I don't know if info dump was the correct way to do it, but apparently it all worked out in the long run.
Meanwhile, Claire is burgling the Institute. Here's the answer to my question earlier about Roger's feeling about the notebook. Diana writes, quote, as Master Raymond had told me in Paris, the power and the danger of magic lie in the people who believe it. I felt an almost physical revulsion at touching it, meaning the notebook. Knowing who had written it, I knew it for what it was, a grimoire, a magician's book of secrets, unquote. She takes the book, quote, I felt as though I were transporting a bomb, Claire says, unquote. She stops at an Italian restaurant and looks through the notebook with a glass of Chianti. It was late April, only a few days before Beltane, May Day. She makes a possible connection between the date and the stones and one's passage through the stones. She remembers her own passage on a May 1st, a Beltane, which was 1945, and she orders a glass of wine number 2. More musings. Only certain people who could travel? Jamie hadn't been able to, but Galus could. She orders a meal and continues to contemplate what she was doing regarding Galus. Did she have a right to meddle and perhaps put Roger in danger? She remembers something Jamie had said. Quote, it isn't a matter of right, Sassenach. It's a question of duty, of honor, unquote. After she finishes her meal, she dives into the notebook.
And that was chapter 48. And now on to the last chapter of Dragonfly and Amber. Can we take a moment of silence? Chapter 49, Blessed Are Those... ... It's a choose-your-own-adventure kind of a title.
They are headed to the stones. Claire is fiddling in her pockets and describes different pieces of debris. Coins, shredded tissue, a pencil stub, a rubber ball, a quarter, an English penny, and the key to Gillian Edgar's carol at the Institute. Was it just me, or did these pockets seem to remind you a bit of Jamie's sporran? A little bit of everything.
They did, but I also thought to myself, how many people have worn this coat? Because those are not like the ingredients.
And I don't think this is the first time we heard about, maybe to every single thing. I think we hear about some of the stuff in her pockets early in the book. I think we hear about it in the first installment.
Well, they lost me at a 60s. Rubber ball. Like, I was like, tissue, okay, I get it. Like, fluff, I could see that. Like, the things you expect to find in a pocket, like pocket lint, tissue, blah, 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 coin.
But Jamie's was much more, I'll say normal.
This was practical.
Well, it had practical stuff as well as stuff that was mementos.
Like I said, rubber ball.
Well, that's practical. You can have a game or play jacks.
There were no jacks in there, though.
But you can still play jacks if you get jacks.
Where are you going to get jacks? You can't buy jacks without the ball. Why would you just keep the ball?
You can still play ball or play jacks. I'm not going to let that one go. Okay, so she tried to call Greg Edgars before they left the manse, but there was no answer. Thinking on the notebook, Claire remembers what she'd seen and what she'd recognized. Jillian had noted her, quote, observations. These listed fire feasts or sun feasts, Beltane, Samhain, etc. Another section entitled Speculations mentioned the druids who had burned victims. She wondered, or for sacrifice. She wondered, Jillian did, was it the burning or the blood that was necessary? Finally, under conclusions, which led them to the stones on the eve of Beltane. As they pull up to the park before walking to the stones, Claire says, she's here. Claire noticed a car parked behind the thicket. Edgar's car, but he wasn't in it. Roger and Brianna follow Claire up the path. Claire was already had already gone. Brianna says to Roger as they walk up the hill, this is silly. Roger sees a flicker of light. He sees Claire shaking her head, quote, as if trying to dismiss a buzzing insect, unquote. That's the first hint. She steps back and runs into Roger. She was feeling the stones. Roger then suddenly smells petrol. He saw a hunched black figure on the grass in the middle of the ring of stones. Claire calls out, Jillian! And then the flames burst up. Once he's able to see again, Roger sees Jillian dressed in a long, full skirt and tight bodice, the clothes of another time.
She was clearly more prepared than Claire.
Oh, heck yeah. Well, she planned it.
Yes.
She had turned at Claire's call, and Roger had seen her briefly, her eyes, her hair. And then he smells the burnt hair and skin. It had to be Greg. He enters the circle and runs toward Galus. She sees him coming, and then she runs toward the cleft in the stone. Before she goes through, though, she turns back and looks at him. Now, how was Roger affected by the happenings? Quote, the fire, the body, the night itself disappeared abruptly in a shriek of blinding noise. Roger found himself face down in the grass, clutching at the earth in frantic search of a familiar sensation to which to anchor his sanity. The search was in vain. None of his senses seemed to function. Even the touch of the ground was insubstantial, amorphous, as though he lay on quicksand, not granite. Blinded by whiteness, deafened by the scream of rending stone, he groped, flailing wildly, out of touch with his own extremities, conscious only of an immense pull and the need to resist it. There was no sense of time passing. It felt as though he had been struggling in emptiness forever, when he at last became aware of something outside himself. Unquote. Hands gripped him. Someone was calling his name, or calling him names. Idiot, jerk, ass. The smell of petrol was overwhelming, and he vomits. Brianna says, oh God, I didn't think I could stop you. You were crawling straight to it. Unquote. He still had pain in his head. He felt as if he'd been split into several pieces. Brianna has heard the sounds too. And then they remember Claire. They find Claire senseless in the grass near the edge of the circle. She had been knocked out. Roger carries her down to the car. Brianna drives them back to the manse.
Now, what do you think knocked her out? I was confused. Did she just pass out? Did somebody hit her?
Well, Roger almost passed out just being...
Yeah, but he was Claire... not at the edge of the circle.
No, he was in the circle. It. Yeah, but Claire is so sensitive to these. And I'm thinking, I think we have evidence. She gets... it's worse each time she goes through.
That's true.
And so this is not her third time, but the third time... No.
She's no virgin.
No, it's not her third time going through, but think about it. There's her first time she goes to the stone circle, which she goes through. The second time she goes to the circle, which she does not go through. The third time she goes to the stone circle, which she does go through. This is her fourth time to this circle. Not her fourth time through, but her fourth time to it. And so we know that each time she actually goes through, it gets worse. But I would say because of that, even being around them makes it worse. But the going through is the worst part. But I think she's unlike a vaccination where you don't get sick after you've been inoculated. This is like the opposite.
No, okay.
I guess. When Claire comes to, her first words are, did she go back? Lisa T. writes, Roger and Brianna get their first taste of the power of the stones. Brianna, quite shaken, asks, it was true then? Everything was true? Roger takes her hand and thinks of the verse. Quote, blessed are those who have not seen and have believed, unquote. Claire's body relaxes. quote, the pale lips curved in the shadow of a smile, and a look of profound peace smoothed the strained white face and settled glowing in the golden eyes. It's true. Would your mother lie to you? Unquote.
Can you imagine the entire drive to the stones of them live? She's like, so mom, is it going to happen? Is she going to go through the stones? Is this what's going to happen? She's just going to walk up and what? She's just going to disappear? She's just going to go back in time through the standing circle of stones.
I think it was a silent trip.
Well, I'm sure that the trip back was.
No, I think this trip to the stones was silent because Brianna's like a sulky teen, like, oh, I can't believe my mom's dragging me to this. And Claire's like, this is going to be awful. I don't want to be around the stones, but if this is the only thing that can prove is like literally seeing is believing, this will make Roger a firm believer and this will hopefully crack Brianna's tude.
I just know that I would have been so relieved that my mother was passed out on the drive back to the house. Because while I was, maybe concerned that she was okay, I would not have been ready for the I told you so conversation.
So they do call the police and a doctor, and the doctor attends to Claire, and the police attend to the situation of the stones. They give a statement, and they're going to go collect Edgar's body and file a report about Jillian, who had murdered her husband and then fled. Literally.
Good luck finding her.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't have time cops yet.
Nope, exactly. Roger goes to bed, and when he wakes up later that evening, Claire and Brianna are helping Fiona with dinner. Lisa T. writes, Claire and Brianna have made peace with each other, and just when we think the story has come to a heartbreaking but peaceful ending, Roger decides to share some very important information with Claire. After a quiet dinner, Claire goes to be by herself for a bit. Roger goes to his research and ponders something he'd found. He wonders if he should tell Claire something. Doesn't think it would bring her comfort if he told her, but again, he thinks he should, if they've gone this far, he thinks she has a right to know. He tells her he has something to tell her about Jamie. Quote, the last thing he meant to do. I think he failed. Her face paled suddenly and she glanced wide-eyed at the book. Unquote. She asked if it was his men. Roger says no. I'm fairly sure he got them out. He meant to turn back to go to the battle. And I think he did that too. He reads the paragraph. Quote, after the final battle at Culloden, 18 Jacobite officers, all wounded, took refuge in the old house, and for 2 days, their wounds untended, lay in pain. Then they were taken out to be shot. One of them, a Fraser of the Master of Lovett's regiment, escaped the slaughter. The others were buried at the edge of the domestic park. Unquote. He meant to die on Culloden Field, Roger whispered, but he didn't.
Goose pimples!
Lisa T. writes, this is a stunning way to end the story. So many questions and a tiny flame of hope. Well, there goes Ginger's favorite book of the series. I can't believe it took us a year.
Well, now we can.
Among other things.
But now we can move on to my favorite book of the series.
Oh, that's right. And you know what? Voyager, I honestly think, other than Echo, I think Voyager has like the most high adventure. Don't you?
Oh, it's swashbuckly adventure.
Oh,
and I had a really hard time saying that just now.
Swashbuckling. And we're not drinking at all.
Swashbuckling.
I'll buckle a swash for you. I don't even know what that means. So yeah, it's very briefly, I don't know how I feel. I know I'm excited because us finishing this, even though right now as we're recording this, we're still about a month away from the premiere. But the time this airs, it's going to be so much closer to the premiere. So the fact that we're finishing it is good because it's a step on the journey to the premiere. We had to do this and get it out before the premiere, which is fine, but it's still bittersweet because I don't know how much more French we're going to get to have you two.
You know what? I'm honestly looking a little bit forward to I know we meet them in Fiery Cross. I don't know if we meet them before then.
The Germans?
The Germans, because I can pronounce all of that.
The McGillivrys?
That's not a German name.
No, but Uta McGillivray. McGillivray. I can never say that name. Her name is Uta. And Manfred, her sons, who get the herp.
I'm just saying the herp. Why are you giving herp away, man?
Oh, no. Is it herp or is it the other?
The gonosyphal herpalades. Just get them all in there. It's got one of them's got to be right.
Did you just make that up?
No.
I've never heard that ever. Say that again.
The gonosyphal herpalades.
I'm thinking of, I guess, the sif. Is what I was thinking of.
Well, if you just say gonosyphal herpalades, it covers almost everything.
No. So, yeah, we don't have a date yet, but we should, after season two, and I think, because we don't know the dates of even the season except for when it starts, it's 13 episodes, so roughly 13 weeks. The two holidays that fall in that time period are, in America at least, are Memorial Day, the last Monday of May, and of course, the 4th of July, which I think is a Sunday this year. All that to be said, sometimes they will not show a new episode on a weekend that's a holiday weekend in any way, right? Because of to not miss out on people being home and able to watch. So if it's those two, let's just for say for giggles, that makes a 13-week season into a 15-week season as far as getting the spread out. The show's spread.
Yeah, full disclosure, we're not even going to touch Voyager until...
Oh, no. Well, hold on. So if we think about that and just say... So basically April, I think I did the math on a calendar once or a few times. I think it takes us to at least early July, if not mid-July. And then if you look at July, we've got some things going on. But also, I am pretty sure the show will end before Comic-Con. Comic-Con is going back the end of July or near the end of July this year, like on the 21st, 22nd, I think. So definitely, I'm pretty sure the show will be done by then. I'm thinking it'll only get out to the 4th or at the latest, the weekend after the 4th. But anyway, all that to say, we would not be having a Voyager read-along beginning until, honestly, probably August, because once the show ends, there's going to be like debriefing. We're going to need to like get out of our system and say, holy crap, we have another, you know, what, 9 months or whatever it is till the next one starts. We will be including announcements because hopefully we get a season 3 announcement. And if that happens, then, you know, they'll probably begin filming season 3 this summer. They have to.
Well, all of this to say, really, if you don't own Voyager yet, don't pay for expedited shipping. You don't need it yet. You can wait. Send it slow boat.
But if you have Amazon Prime, you can get 2-day shipping because it doesn't cost you extra.
It doesn't.
Unless you get the ebook, in which case there is no shipping.
I'm just saying, if you don't have Amazon Prime and your local bookseller doesn't have it on stock and you need to order it.
Don't rush.
No rush. Take your time. We have an entire season of Outlander to get through first.
Oh my gosh. And I'm not wishing away time because it's going to be balls to the wall again, but oh so much fun. And
scene.
So we look forward to the start of season 2 and a whole bunch of fun stuff. And I mean everything. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to all the next episodes.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/Outlander Pod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.